time.
Okay. I'm Dr. Hermanson, chairperson of the osteopathic physician licensing board. I would like to call this meeting of the osteopathic physician licensing board to order. It is now 9 a.m. on May 9th, 2019. This meeting is being held in room 464 of the Heber and Wells building in Salt Lake City, Utah. Notice that this meeting was provided as required under Utah's open meeting laws. In compliance with Utah's open meeting laws, this meeting is being recorded in its entirety. The recording will be posted to the Utah Public Notice website and related in 3 business days following the meeting. In compliance with Utah's open meeting laws, written minutes will also be prepared at this meeting. Appropriately marked, quote, pending approval minutes will be available to the public no later than 30 days after the close of the meeting. Approved minutes will be posted to the Utah Public Notice website no later than 3 business days after approval. The following board members, committee members, commissioner members are in attendance: myself, Dr. Lynn Hermanson, Dr. Jacob Jessup, Dr. Lindsay Drew, and Dr. Jessica Edgar, public member. The following individuals representing DOCL and Department of Commerce are in attendance: Larry Marks, Bureau Manager, Lisa Martin, Board Secretary, Nina Bowen, Compliance Specialist, and
James Ferner, DOCL Investigator.
Okay, all right. We welcome any visitors and interested persons at this time. Please be sure to sign the attendance report for the meeting and identify yourself before speaking. As a courtesy to everyone participating in this meeting, at this time we ask for all cell phones, pagers, and other electronic devices to be turned off or changed to silent mode. Board motions and votes will be recorded in a minute. Let us now proceed with the agenda. Okay, so I'm new to this. Okay, from the file. Okay. The icon is the file. There we go. Agenda. So we have the February 14th, 2019 minutes that will be approved. Is there any questions that we have of those board meeting minutes? Do we have a motion?
I'll motion.
Second.
Okay. All in favor of approving the February 14th, 2019 minutes?
Aye.
Aye. Okay. I'm at the end of my term. I've served 2 terms and filled in for someone else's partial term. So today is my last board meeting. It's been a joy to serve on the board as a member of the osteopathic physician community. It's been a wonder to witness the healing that probationaries go through, and to see the transformation that they go through, and to help protect the public, and that's what our purpose is here. And I wish the board well in the future, and it keeps on going and going and going, and it's time to vote for the next board chairman. We have 2 POs here. Some of the responsibilities would include chairing our quarterly DOPL meetings. And the one that's most time-consuming is the end of each April. There's required attendance at the FSMB, Federal State Medical Board's meetings, and that's Wednesday through Sunday. And you're a voting delegate representing Utah Osteopathic Board. So you have 2 DOs here that are available to be voted on, Dr. Jacob Jessup and Dr. Lindsay Drew. Share your thoughts.
First of all, do you want to do it? I was thinking that if nobody else wanted to do it, I would do it, because
I was
the
same
oldest
thing.
Person.
And this vote comes up each year.
Does it?
So if you want to do it a year, and then you want to do it a year, however, it comes up a year. So it's not like you're locked in.
And the next FSMB meeting is in San Diego.
In San Diego. They have one on the East Coast one year, the West Coast one that year, and then they meet in Midwest. They're in well, not over, but in Texas. And so they kind of alternate every.
So how many? I mean, how much time would you say you're putting in?
You're so besides this meeting,
yeah. Is it just that meeting?
It's that April meeting. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I'll get an email or a call. I mean, very random. Mm-hmm. Maybe like once a year, if even that, where Larry will call me and we'll talk for 5-10 minutes about a certain case. Or he'll warn me and say, hey, there's some things coming up at this case, just so that you're aware. But the main time consuming thing is taking time off work for that April meeting.
I have the same sentiment that you have.
You've been on the board for how long?
I know I've gone through one
since 2012.
Okay,
and I think that was the year after, wasn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
So I would be fine if I did it first and then you can take over.
So we need a motion.
I move that Dr. Lindsay Drew become the board chair for the fall.
Second.
Okay. All right. So congratulations. Today is going to be a very, probably our shortest meeting that I've attended. We have one probationary interview.
We should read the 2 minutes.
Oh, we already did.
Oh, you did it.
Yeah.
So, we'll start with an investigation update.
You ready for that?
Yeah.
Okay. Just take one and pass it along. There's not a lot to look at, which is good. On the third column from the left, under 2019, that reflects the months January through March. And then that far right-hand column where it says April-19 is just for the month of April, and their statistics have not been gathered for the month of May yet. So you'll notice that in April there was one administrative filing, and one letter of concern, 5 cases received, 5 assigned, and 4 closed for the month of April. And year-to-date numbers are just over to the left of that. So there have been a total of 15 cases received, 13 of which were assigned, and 13 of which were closed. Don't know that they're the same cases, but the ones that were closed are not necessarily the ones that were opened in that same period. Tends to be an overlap. It takes some time to go through those cases. Any questions on that?
Yeah, in the future, is there a way to not necessarily break down the physicians involved, but maybe categorize what the cases were involved?
We're not able to do that.
Okay.
What happens, though, is where there are administrative filings and there's been a disposition to a case,
mm-hmm.
we're able to give some information on that.
Okay.
Is that a correct
reflection
there?
And kind of the purpose there is if there's a
pattern.
If patterns, we can go out and educate. Mm-hmm. It can be part of our education in the meetings that doctors have.
What I can do is talk to people in my office and just do a survey and say, what are you noticing, any trends, what are those trends?
Yeah, trends that we can address, we can get out to our colleagues that are creating CMEs and it's like, hey, you know, it would be good if we brought in someone to talk about this.
Okay.
Because we're, yeah.
And Larry, have you identified any? You seem to be at the top of a funnel.
You know, for osteopaths, I don't know what this case is on the filing. I don't know who that case, I haven't seen it, so I don't know on that. But
and maybe it would be even just a general among just the physicians, of all physicians.
It continues to be drug-related issues.
Is it drug? Okay.
And boundary issues.
Okay, yeah, it's the same old, same old.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that seems to be with almost all the healthcare professions.
It's a constant.
So, there's an article in the paper today dealing with an allopathic physician and cosmetic surgery, which is, according to Desert News, an issue. high demand for those procedures, and people are doing a way to make money, even though they may not be trained or certified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Any questions? All right. You're excused.
Thank you.
To
appreciate
you. You bet.
Okay. Dr. Wilson is coming in today to have the board review his practice plan and CV for a possible new supervisor. I don't believe the supervisor is coming in. We're going to speak with him over the phone.
Okay. The supervisor over the phone?
Yes.
Okay.
But Dr. Wilson should be here. Other than that, he's attending his therapy. But not any, really any other reports or anything.
Well,
but he has been attending.
Yeah.
And nothing else.
And I was, after our last meeting, we wanted him to complete a...
polygraph
and to provide the fitness for duty. He provided both of those, and I was under the order I was required to give him his license. He does have his license now. But he still has to do the practice plan, do the supervisor, do what he has to do. So he'll have to have the practice plan approved today and the supervisor approved today. He has been excluded from Medicare, Medicaid, and we'll continue on.
So we are waiting for him.
Mm-hmm.
So is it accurate that he does not need chaperone from the room?
Yes. That's a problem. Only a door. An interesting thing that Dr. Hermanson and I learned, I don't know if the class of some people, but in a course we had, there's developing evidence that chaperones don't work. Not suggesting using them, that there has to be other ways to do it. Chaperones are effective. We've had several. This is nationwide.
That wasn't in that one class.
It was fascinating.
I would think that they would do more to protect you medical legally than somebody being predatory and having boundary issues. But I don't know.
Yeah, the evidence suggests it's not effective.
For either way?
Yeah, of course, their solution is simple revocation, which is definitely would work. Sometimes it's not possible.
Maybe it's just, the MA wants to protect their job.
Well, I think that's it, and that's the problem, is having independent chaperones. And I think that's the challenge, because to require that, it's
expensive that they can't pay. Is a chaperone normally somebody who is a subordinate to the provider?
Well, we try to write it up so that it's not, that they don't have any supervisory relationship. And even if they're not, if they're an MA who's employed by another doctor, a lot of times they still feel that as supervisory.
You feel that hierarchical
inherent conflict of interest,
which makes it
set up whether it's right or wrong. There's a lot that's being done in medicine to try and break down barriers to people being able to voice concerns, and in the OR in particular, the VA has an initiative called Stop the Line, wherein anybody in the room who sees a problem with something, whether they're, housekeeping staff or, the physician, anybody in between in terms of, educational background, can say, hey, I think that's a problem. And, it's a systemic effort to try and make it. But, how that's implemented in private practices and other institutions is going to be variable, but...
I can appreciate how it would be challenging to have other options besides, you know, you said it would be cost prohibitive, but in other industries where you have a proctor, a video proctor, well, your patient doesn't necessarily want to be on a video either.
Yeah.
For anyway, although that would create some convenience if mm-hmm. you had an independent proctor on a video that wasn't recording but could see it. But yeah, I hadn't thought about who actually the people were who were.
Yeah, it's difficult.
So his ability to get the license back was based on the court
agreement. Yeah.
So that was outside of what we did here, right?
Yeah.
That was.
But he did comply with what we wanted. It's just I wasn't able to wait.
Yeah. So.
The idea was kind of that we would probably give it back today.
I still have serious concerns. Yeah. Pediatric patient, obviously.
So basically,
not pediatric patients,
he's going to be in his own practice. We have a supervisor, no one younger than 18, cash pay, working 45 to 55 hours, depending on his ability to even see that amount of workload.
And he lives in Bountiful, and the practice is a Farmington.
So did he move then from up in
Wall? His supervisor lives in Bountiful.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I have a Bountiful address.
I mean, it's just.
Oh, so he's still in Morgan then.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'm just concerned because, you know, psychiatric patients are vulnerable patients. You know, and
some of the vulnerable things that I've come across with psychiatric issues is when patients have psychiatrist's phone and they start texting.
Yeah.
And it's the texting late at night, just like happened with Dr. Conkley.
Yeah.
They just, you know, the patients start getting infatuated, or the doctor gets infatuated,
mm-hmm.
and
the counter transference
and
all that.
Yeah.
And we see it with all the mental health profession.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know, we'll have to, that's something to ask him if the patients are going to have.
He did say, for in terms of after hours, or on call, if after hours an emergency,
yeah, he may say that. But what about if he was to say, "Hey, here's my personal."
Yeah. Well, and it goes on to response. Otherwise, I will have a separate business line to respond to non-emergency
yeah,
calls.
Yeah, and we just need to reemphasize that he can't. He, you know, it would not be good for him to just, you know, on an individual basis give his cell phone out to a patient.
Yeah.
Even if it's a business line,
it's just
something to carry.
Yeah, it's his private business line, so.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's what it sounds like. You know, I will have a separate business line to respond to non-emergency calls.
Okay, all right.
So.
Yeah, it's probably a cell
business cell.
Yeah,
it's the same
and like
issue.
It's the same, yeah.
Yeah,
I was dating a gal. We just got out of a movie. It was like 12:15 at night, and someone texted her. I said, "Who's texting me at this late at night?" She said, "Well, that's my doctor." I said, "Why is your doctor texting me at 4:15 at night? He's seeing if I'm depressed." I'm like, "What?" It's like a booty call or something.
Yeah, no. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Sir, we were outside. I'm sure Isaacson and Dr. Wilson, the attorney, figured you'd come grab us. So, good morning.
Welcome, Dr. Wilson. Jessica's going to interview you. Okay.
Welcome back. We're glad to be welcome. So we'll just have a discussion again today. So we're just checking out updates and a few questions about it. So tell us, since we last met, we know your license is back,
mm-hmm.
and we certainly see your question, but just give us a quick summary on how things are going, what updates have happened since we met.
Sure. So, since the license was reinstated, I first started looking for employment and learned, I didn't know this, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but apparently I'm on the exclusion list for Medicaid and Medicare, so that kind of limits, my understanding is that limits me quite a bit as far as where I can be employed, and so... So I'm sort of in that process of trying to get reinstated on that list again. So I had a couple, one employer in particular that was interested, but then they sent me an email saying that, you know, I was on that exclusion. Oh, that's right, I was on that exclusion list. So I'm in the process of trying to get reinstated with that. And that, I guess it can take up to, 90 to 120 days or something. So So I'm in the process of doing that. I found someone who would be willing to supervise me, which is Dr. Austin Hyannis in Farmington. He's a psychiatrist and you know, so he's wanting to do that. I had originally submitted a practice plan to see voc rehab patients, only because I had a contact who felt that maybe I'd be a good fit for that. And so initially that seemed to look positive for me. But then they sent me, so they weren't comfortable sending me patients. And so that happened maybe a couple weeks ago. And so sort of back to a little bit limbo because I'm waiting for that, of course, that exclusion to be reinstated. And then also kind of the plan was about rehab, but now since I can't do that, I'm looking into maybe getting personal malpractice insurance and then maybe trying to get credentials from insurance companies at this point, maybe seeing patients on an outpatient basis at his building. So that's sort of the plan at this point. We'll still feel like I'm a little bit limbo as far as employment. So I got the polygraph. So
yeah, looks like you've checked off everything from our office.
I think so. Yeah.
Thanks for doing all those.
Yeah.
And you did those speedily, so that that helped your cause to get into practice.
Of course. So.
Yeah. How about talk to me a little bit? Talk to us about therapy. How are
That's good. Start with individual therapy, so I think you've seen that. And that's going fine. Had originally, so we're a little bit tough spot right now financially. So was seeing him on a weekly basis. I've kind of thought about backing away to every other week only because the finances are just really tough for us right now. So I just don't know how to, we have a lot of challenges as far as our finances. So, I really like him. He's great. I mean, as far as, visiting with him, and I felt like I'd seen him over a year now, and so I felt like I have a good relationship with him, and he understands the issues and really well. So I have a really good connection with him, just kind of financially. I don't mind seeing him every week at all. Yeah. It's just the finances really is what it comes down to. And then as far as marriage therapy, we scheduled with someone, like an online person for marriage therapy back in March. We did that only because we're up in Morgan, so kind of traveling is difficult for us. We have our handicapped daughter, which is sort of difficult with her, and finding a babysitter for her who's qualified to be with her is sort of difficult. So we thought that would really be a little bit easier. But we just didn't, we did one session, well, not in a session, it was get to know you for 15 minutes, and didn't feel it was going to be helpful for several reasons. But so we scheduled with another therapist, and he was in Layton. And we went down to Stockham, but again, didn't feel it was a good fit. And I feel it needs to be a good fit, for us. And we both didn't feel it was a good fit. So I went ahead and spoke to Matt. Matt spoke to a couple other, my individual therapist, and he spoke to a couple other people, and I explained to my situation. So we now have another appointment for a marriage counselor June the 17th. That's when it is. And so it's trying to get into these folks. They have a long waiting list, and especially good ones. So that's kind of where we're at with that.
So going for that, or keep trying to find that fit?
Yeah, we're hoping to be able to
definitely
find
want that.
I just feel like that would be really important to have that.
Absolutely.
As far as like the physician group, I've been attending that at McKinney. So, and that's been fine. No issues there. Done that twice a week. Or excuse me, twice a month.
I have received reports on that.
Uh-huh. So I've been participating in that as well. So.
Are you still, currently employed? You were working with the sanitation department last
year?
Yeah,
right? I'm still doing that full time.
Okay.
So,
One of the things we talked about last time was support systems and how that was creating a stressor in your life. We understand. Talk to me a little bit about how you're feeling from that perspective. A few months have passed. Have you seen improvements? Things changed? How are you feeling about your support system?
You know, Not a lot has changed that way. I mean, I still have, like, well, I mean, somehow, some of this has itself. I mean, again, going to this physician support group, that's changed a little bit. And the fact that, you know, I can feel like you can sort of relate to, you know, the professionals that are there. So that's been a little bit of a change.
Is that getting easier? She did state in your reports that you were kind of having a hard time in that meeting just because your circumstances are a little bit different.
Well, I don't know about a hard time. I wouldn't describe it that way. It's hard to relate a little bit to some of their, because it's substance abuse, mm-hmm. you know, for them. And,
well, it's addiction, but most
right,
of those
right.
are.
You know, yeah, they're talking about support groups or, you know, sponsors and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And so, I mean, I don't feel like I have any problems with addiction. But as far as like support, I feel like that's been helpful.
Okay.
I mean, a place where I can kind of talk about what has occurred and sort of what's going on in our, you know, my personal life. I feel like that's been helpful, definitely. So I don't know about hard. It's just maybe, you know, sort of maybe harder to relate, I would say.
How do you feel you're handling those stressors? You mentioned financial. What are you doing to cope with stressors?
Just all the things that we've talked about so far. I mean, individual therapy, you know, group therapy. I personally do a lot of exercise, and that's, to me, very beneficial, actually. So I am an avid. I work out every day, a good hour a day. And that's, for me, very helpful for mental perspective. So that's very helpful. And then just trying to, again, do everything I can to try to progress things forward, you know, with employment and that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that, you know, when we get into maybe, you know, doing some of the therapy, marriage therapy, that my life and my relationship can improve, you know, be better. So I'm hoping that will be helpful as well, kind of strengthen our relationship and, you know, have better support that way. So.
And reviewing your practice plan and your supervisor, one question came up related to boundaries specifically, because we've seen a lot of people who are in psychiatric provider situations who receive personal texts, whether it's on a business line or a personal line, it doesn't really matter if you're getting texts and messages late at night. I kind of want to hear your thoughts on that. You may run into that situation. We know it's an adult population. It doesn't matter. You might have others who are interested in crossing the boundaries. How will you guard yourself from that? What are your strategies for making sure that those boundaries stay safe?
That's a good question. This is all sort of new to me, mm-hmm. only because I was employed before, so
yeah.
they took care of most all of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as you talk, of course, then I begin thinking, oh, what? That's a good point. What, you know, what can I do to curb that? So I haven't actually really thought about that.
It's relevant
because,
to anybody, right?
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. So, but again, I'm sort of at the point where I need to get malpractice first, and how much is that going to be, and will they provide me a plan, and then will I get credentialed? So it feels like that's several steps. I mean, obviously something I need to think about, but it seems like several steps beyond where I'm at this point. So
your practice planning, you talk about, you know, emergency situations and non-emergency situations. That might be an opportunity as you're getting into that step to clarify what that means. You know, consider automatic responses when someone's non-emergent, not available, that kind of thing.
I mean, I was going to say, ideally, I'd really like to be an employee
yeah.
at this point. And that's ideally only because that would just make everything a little bit easier, I think, as far as structure and, you know, like practice and all these other things
yeah.
that go along with being an employee. So ideally, that's what I'd prefer to do, and have Dr. Imus as my supervisor. But you have to wait that 90 to 120 days for it to get reinstated. So
do you know the likelihood of that happening?
I don't. I have no idea. I don't know how to even. I've thought about that. Like, what would be the likelihood? I don't even know how to find out.
Have you talked to, insurance panelers? Oftentimes they follow suit with the federal payers and government payers. Have you done any sort of investigation with them to kind of see what they're expecting?
I haven't. I need to get to that point. Right. Yeah, I need to. That's probably something I need to do. Another thing on my list I need to do. But yeah, that's what I want to do.
One of the things I was just thinking of as we were talking about Jessica's question with regard to how to handle the emergency situations. I'm going to disagree with you because you're talking about that being several steps down after you find out about the insurance malpractice, that kind of thing. Personally, for me, I would like to see you kind of flip that and how are you going to implement your practice is the first step. How are you going to have your protections, for yourself and for patients, first step. And then the business, which I can malpractice and, whether it's cash pay or insurance or employer, that to me is the secondary step. And we're all here on the board because our job and our responsibility is first and foremost patient protection, and and then secondarily helping physicians who have had stumbling blocks, helping them to get past that. And so with that being our first priority, patient protection. I kind of would ask that be your first, priority and good clinical practice before the financial and before the malpractice and all that.
And for you, protection against you too.
Right.
Yeah. Text, a phone, someone texting you late at night, that may be infatuated with you. That's where a lot of issues come up. Here in board meetings, mm-hmm. And then likewise, you have a text that you're texting back and forth with the patient. It just turns into out of bounds, and you got to protect yourself. And that all doctors do, but you could be a target from someone.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I just haven't thought that far ahead as far as my because I don't have a business model yet in place, so I don't even, because I could foresee myself 2 or 3 months from now, if I don't get malpractice, or if it's too expensive, then maybe you become an employee and it's a different situation. So I just haven't really thought that far ahead, only because I don't know.
When you get that part, maybe that's something you can add as an addendum to your practice.
Definitely. Yeah, it's not finished by any stretch. Yeah.
Well, but then that's the other thing. If you structure your practice model, as in your interaction with the patients first, that may help structure the other stuff secondarily. I mean, that may that if you have because right now it sounds to me like you're prioritizing. Okay, how am I going to afford this? How am I going to get paid? That sounds like that's your the way this reads. And I'm not trying to be difficult about that, but it reads to me like that is the first priority there, and I think you need to flip that to what's my practice model going to be, how is my patient interaction, how am I going to have good clinical practice first and foremost, and then the rest of those, that may help inform how the rest of that will go.
Oh, yeah, I can certainly. Yeah, I just haven't thought. That's how I started thinking about that. Yeah. So, yeah.
I think that's a good suggestion about an addendum to your practice plan that addresses personal contact, what's non-emergency, what's emergency.
Maybe start seeing patients before you actually see the first patient, you could say, hey, I'm submitting a practice plan, because those things can be just sent to us in an email. Okay. To review.
Yeah, that's my plan. Yeah, that's absolutely before I would ever do anything. I'd make sure that's.
So process that outlines, what happens if after our phone call or texting, what happens if it's an emergency, what's non-emergency, that just like we're saying, from a as a public member, and we're talking about, we look at the patient. I don't want to create a potentially bad situation for anyone, you as a provider or the patient is getting involved in an inappropriate relationship also. So if we can outline a process, I think that'd be useful for everybody. I understand you haven't thought about it. You've got a lot going on, but I'd like to see that too. Does anybody have questions?
I was just going to say, on top of that, I've been on the board now for six years?
I think so.
Something like that. And so as I've seen how patients, the things that have, from a boundary standpoint, that have gotten patients in trouble, it starts with they've had marital stress, they've had some financial stress, they haven't had, and certainly, I mean, that's all happened here, and they haven't had a good process in place ahead of time, and then all of a sudden they're down a road that they never expected to be down, and then they're trying to find their way back. And the providers who have been the most successful, who have been able to claw their way back, have been very willing and open to talk with us about, what they put in place, and they've been very willing and open to talk with their supervisor and their employee, or not employees, because they don't have them, most of them are not ending up with employees, but with the support staff that they're working with, to say, hey, this is the situation, I can't do that. And then with patients, obviously, you don't need to go, it'd be inappropriate to go into that sort of thing with them, but, they have their boundaries set. And they say, well, this is how I do it. And if somebody's asking for an exception, whether it's a coworker or a support staff or a patient, they say, well, this is how I do it. And I'm thinking of one provider in particular who it was actually for him, I think, he had a realization like, oh, wow, this just having these in place just makes it easier, and why would I do it any other way if it puts me at risk or puts my patients at risk? And so, I think that's why we're talking about, the having the boundaries in place. Not that there has been any allegation of provider to patient boundary issues here, but that you have risk factors for that with the marital stress, with the financial stress, with the just change in support in your community, your local community because of what's happened, and so I think, again, that's why I go, and this is a long-winded kind of way of getting at, this is why I go back to saying the first priority is, so I would start thinking about that now and putting that down on paper and then planning the rest of it after that.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
So I think that sounds good. What questions do you have of us?
Let's see. There was a couple of things. With Dr. Imus, how often, I don't know if we've gotten to that point yet, how often do you want me to visit with him? I guess I need to visit with him at a certain frequency and then also provide a report.
His reports have to come in every month. Mm-hmm. For probably the first 6 months. He does. Is he aware that he has to do the surveillance form?
Yes.
Or okay.
Yeah.
And have your computer monitor checked.
Yeah.
And
yeah. Did he send? He said he sent. I gave him the certificate of receipt that he received the stipulation, and he said he faxed it back.
I would have to check your file. He may have.
Okay.
I'll have to check on that.
Yeah, but he's aware of that.
Do you have his phone number to call him?
Okay, great.
Whenever you guys are ready, you can call.
And he said he'd be available on my contact fingers and things, so we want to write down his phone number.
Okay, write it.
We're on public record here, so that would probably just write it down.
Let's see, yes, I do have that.
Supervisor?
voicemail with Dr. Imus. If you are a patient wanting to make an appointment, please leave your name, phone number.
I think that maybe we could address the board's feelings about him seeing Matt Loveland every other week as opposed to weekly, just install his employment a little bit better. So he's been even seeing Matt for a long time. Matt's a very well-known therapist up in Kaysville. I've had many clients go to him. I think they have a really good rapport. I think keep seeing letters from him. But if the board was okay with him seeing every other week, I think that from a financial perspective would be a nice thing for Dr. Wilson.
What does the stipulation say?
I don't know that even says.
It does not state that he has to see him a certain amount of times a month.
Okay.
But that we do need the report for the first 6 months.
Well, it's something that we're not monitoring the account is going.
Every other week is fine.
Mm-hmm. So if that's
Yeah, that's a good arrangement. Yeah, he said that would be fine.
That we would not have to vote on because it's not part of your your order.
And I'm willing to go every week. It's just the financial stress. But
I think you said monthly we get from the therapist too, so at least monthly.
As long as we get report every month for the first 6 months.
How is your community? How are you in your community up in Morgan? Any improvements?
No real change. I mean, I don't know that there can be. I don't know how I could improve that. I mean, it's just kind of the way it is.
You were thinking about relocating before. Are you still considering?
It saves money.
It does save money.
Yeah, and so that's definitely an option that we've been thinking about. I just
And then I don't remember the fitness for duty evaluator. What was their recommendation as far as groups go? What was the?
Just that I attend. I think the
And then you wanted to do the Ogden, the group up there.
Mm-hmm. And what's the frequency of that?
Twice a month.
A lot of that we defer to. We defer to Matt on frequency. Usually, I think it says in the stipulation, based upon the evaluation. If the evaluator says, we've reached a point where I can see you every 6 months, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
If they say we need to see you every week, then we expect that. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of up to the evaluator and the patient. Recognizing the financial problems, but I don't think we have a problem with every other week.
Yeah, the fitness for duty that says he should be involved with a peer physician addiction recovery group, as well as the self-help sexual recovery group. So the frequency is not mentioned.
But I think it is important because you are under a great deal of stress. And even though you may not, it may cause more stress in some ways, it still allows that mental health benefit. Should help you in the long run. So.
And it sounds like once you get the federal block cleared
out. Yeah, that will open up a lot of. And like I said, I had a pretty good option at a hospital here in Salt Lake here that I was actually pretty interested until they were having me progress through the interview process all the way through until they found I was on
medication. Yeah, that's great. Should be able to overcome and in total circumstances, it shouldn't be a problem to overcome that. They just do it bureaucratically, so when you appeal that and go through the steps, it should be able to be resolved.
Now, there is, and I'll defer to you both on this, in the summary document, there is a recommendation for weekly individual therapy.
Right.
It's not in the fitness for duty. But
he has been doing that for over a year.
This one, and this is from December. How long do we expect that?
Well, that's just a recommendation, so.
And then we leave it up to the individual therapist.
Yeah,
because that's who is and knowledgeable about what's being affected.
It's just, it seems like some, a lot of times I'm talking about financial stress. Understandably. It's tough with our situation. So I've been out of practice for 6 years, and so it's been trying to keep working. I'm so sorry, you guys. I didn't have the email, but I'll be available. So
you might not recognize
it. Kind of the restroom.
And it happens. That's the danger.
Hi, you have reached the voicemail of Dr. Imus. If you are a patient wanting to make an appointment, please leave your name, phone number, and a brief description of your issue. If this is an emergency and you need to talk to someone immediately, please hang up, dial 911, or go to your local emergency room. You can also call the crisis line at the University of Utah at 801-587-3000. Thank you, and please leave a message after the tone.
Hello, Dr. Imus. This is Jessica Egbert from the Doppel Licensing Board, and we are calling to speak with you regarding Dr. David Wilson. And we will look forward to speaking with you at our next meeting. If you have any questions in the interim, you're welcome to follow up with the Division Bureau Manager, Larry Mark. What's your phone number?
801-530-6254.
Thank you very much.
So what we need to do is, as a board, vote on your practice plan. I would include the amendment of, to approve the supervisor, but I'd include that before you actually start seeing patients, that you provide us an amendment that we can review. But you have a good start, and you're still in the very beginning stages, and we don't want to keep you from that, but there's more that we need.
I completely understand. Yeah, I'm just not to that point anymore.
Yeah.
Okay, should I make that motion, or somebody else make that motion? I move that the board approves the practice plan and supervisor for
separate motion.
And it with the inclusion that you
presented. Yes. I move that the board approves the practice plan for Dr. David Wilson with the amendment that he include, prior to seeing patients, a plan to address personal contact, non-emergency, and emergency situations such as phone calls and texting, and the processes whereby those things will be handled.
Okay, we have a second. All those in favor?
Can we abstain? You can vote.
Mm-hmm. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
We have one abstain.
And then we need to approve the supervisor. So I will move that we approve Dr. Austin Imus as the supervisor for Dr. David Wilson.
Second. Okay. All in favor?
I want to see more information.
Okay.
First.
One abstain. Okay.
So
all in favor? I did that. Okay. So anticipate when you're ready to, we have further information, what you're going to do. We'll provide that to Barry. Lisa will send that out to an email for us to kind of say, hey, look at these. Do you have any questions? Be free. I've been, when I set up my practice, it always takes longer than you think. You may be here in August.
finally sharing this back, but it just takes time.
Can I ask one last question?
Mm-hmm.
DEA, with the set of controls, is that something I need? Because I was the controlled substance licenses reinstated in March. Mm-hmm. Did the DEA need to get renewed or applied for within a certain amount of time after that was issued?
You're supposed to have your DEA license within 90 days, your DEA. If you don't have it, then you have to surrender your
controlled
license. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. So you should try to get that reinstated. It could take a while as well.
Okay. Yeah. It's been almost 90 days, I think, since it was reinstated.
Yeah. Well, and we understand. If you're in the process of trying to get it done, it's those who, the statute's actually for those who have it revoked or simply don't do it.
Okay.
You know, but we understand that you're in the process of getting it, and it is expensive, almost $800. So, but yeah, you need to work on it because they may decline.
Okay.
So you just need to make sure.
Okay.
And our next meeting is August
8th.
And that's when we want 3 months back on it.
So there will be reports that you'll need to provide to Kamina that you've been doing. So each time when you meet, whoever interviews you, get some mark if you're in compliance or not. So you can just kind of go, maybe you want your own little check mark. Hey, a lot of times you get here, the supervisors haven't sent their report. Kind of like, hey, a quick email to your supervisor, a few days before. Hey, did you get, or at the end of each month, hey, did you get that sent in? So that you can check mark on your own that you're in compliance.
He's pretty good about contacting me to see if I've got that he does.
So we'll be interested particularly next time with Dr. Imus's supervisory reports, make sure he understands that, the monitoring process. Sounds like he's aware of all of those things. Should just be hopefully systematic.
And on your DEA number, you wouldn't be able to write a prescription for a controlled substance without it.
And I'll just say, I've been representing Dr. Wilson for 4.5 years now, and I've had super close contact with him. We've had a very close professional relationship, and he's one of the most responsive, diligent, follow-through kind of clients. He reminds me of things that I need to do. So I can just tell you that he's been super proactive. I wasn't able to be here at the first meeting, but this has been a really long process, and he's just everything I've asked him to do, everything anyone's asked him to do, he's followed through with. I know this has been a long struggle, but he very much appreciates what the board has been willing to do, and I can assure you that anything you ask him to do will get done, and he's been very diligent.
Right. Well, we'll anticipate that will continue.
Mm-hmm.
Any other?
No.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to see you August 8th.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
David, just when you'll call me, people proceed in their familiarity of the problems. It's common that they bring their attorney the first few bullets. After that, they kind of get a sense that, I don't think I need my attorney present.
Yeah, I think in the interest of saving funds.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Thank you.
Bye. How do we log in?
Do we have any discussion items or correspondence?
No, I'm just going to do a summary of the FSMB.
It was pretty tame.
Yeah.
It was one of the most tame conferences.
They send a lot of emails that look like it's controversial.
Our EMR years, they were very, you have this, all these EMR companies there to battle all these things. I'm like, whoa. When we got into the legislative part where we vote, it was just like that. There was no one there to It was like, okay, all in favor of this, you push your button, it was just, it went super fast, and I'm like, this is nice. But it just depends on what people in the community, and me, and not just doctors, but someone that wants to present something. I know I got an email a couple of years ago of the PAs wanted to have a seat at the board, and they wanted to have the requirement of being ever supervised by a physician, that as soon as they get out of PA school, they can instantly advertise that they're an oncologist or they're a surgeon or they're a neurosurgeon, and they don't require any additional training or any supervision. And that got shot down even before the conference started, because all these physicians getting this email wrote back and said, this is just a non-starter. And they wrote back and said, this is a non-starter. But that's what everyone wants to push for. Sometimes there'll be pharmacy associations there that want to say, hey, we want to be able to, if someone comes to us at the pharmacy window and says, hey, look at my throat, test my throat, it's strep, give me some amoxicillin, that they want to get into that. So everyone wants to push their licenses, and they start at the FSMB.
They want to expand practice.
Mm-hmm.
The nursing organizations are, the national, local, not necessarily so much, but like the CRNAs nationally, they are aggressive. They'll advertise, we just took the nursing route, and the doctor took the doctor route, but we're the same. It's like,
yeah.
Well, I have about 12,000 to 14,000 hours of training, and you have 1,200 hours of training. So
it's a different type of training.
It is, yeah.
It's a different type of training.
And there's some really good CRNAs there's a lot of really good CRNAs that I really like working with, but it's not the same.
Yeah. They have to work under doctor supervision.
Not in this state. So there's some states that have opt-out, where the governor has just signed, I think it's probably about 22 to 26 states, where the governor has signed that they can have independent practice, and they here that we don't have opt-out, but the way the law is written, they can practice. Well, actually, I think the opt-out states, they're practicing under the surgeon's license. They're technically, the surgeon is their
supervisor,
which the surgeon's not paying. It's appropriate, that they're doing what they're doing. Here, they don't even really have to have.
So they could work for a dentist.
Oh, they do. Yeah. And that's where the legislation, part of where that legislation came from a couple of years ago. We worked with the CRNAs, anesthesiologists and CRNAs worked together to try and pass legislation to say, if you're not an anesthesia provider, you can't push propofol. Well, got up on the hill, or you can't push IV sedation, and got up on the hill, and they said, well, what are the numbers? And we don't really have numbers, because there's not a reporting system for bad outcomes outside of the hospital and ambulatory surgery centers. And so that legislation got passed to say, well, we need to create a database, and we need to see what we're looking at in terms of complications. Whether it's a pain clinic or
a year, so.
Yeah. And so, anyway, I don't know what the numbers are. We created reporting as a task force to help create the reporting mechanism. And I'm not sure where it is right now. But
The Department of Health has the system set up, and I don't know how many reports it can.
So, anyway.
What would motivate someone to even file a report? How do you
require by statute?
Yeah, they're required by statute, and they can be doppel. There can be repercussions to doppel, but
unprofessional conduct if they fail to do it. If there's escalation of care based on an intravenous IV, or if they fail to do certain things.
Yeah.
So. The next FSMB will be April 22nd of 2020 in San Diego.
You said it was Wednesday through Sunday?
Yeah, usually you fly in on Wednesday. Meetings are Thursday, Friday, Saturday, votes Saturday, and then can fly out Saturday night, or you can go to their big fancy party. Or
the only way that Saturday night this time is because I had my board exam that I was studying for and prepping for, but the Saturday night event, the food is incredible. And I wish I could have just stayed for that. And it's like you finally see people wearing Levi's and, you know, before that, it's like everyone's in, you know, all that. And it's like, okay, finally we're, you know, dressing down and people bring their families in that have come to do a little bit of vacation with them. And it's just a nice event. Yeah.
And travel and hotels paid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get a stipend and that you keep track of the receipts and you email them in, and they want you to do your and you'll get this all starting in about November of, hey, make sure you book through only this place. You'll send a copy to Lisa that you booked your hotel and your motel, things like that. Yeah. And then they'll send you that you're now a fellow of the FSMB, and you'll get a little certificate for that. And the most important part of the conference is on the Saturday, where you go and you're actually doing voting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You just kind of show up and you go with the flow. A lot of meetings and breakout sessions,
speakers,
little luncheons here and there, and
is there CMIN with that?
Yeah, there is. Good. There's
7.5.
Yeah, and then you pay separately for that at $75. That's pretty inexpensive.
11, right? Yeah.
But it's not Category 1A. It's Category 2.
Okay.
And I don't know why they do that, but. The MGs get the Category 1 and the DOs get the Category 2. Because it's who's granting the credit hours. Some University of Texas is granting the credit hours. All they need to do is go to a DO school and say, hey, will you be the administrator to grant DO credits to this? Mm. And Dr. Chowdhury's a DO, and every year it's like, why? Here I'm getting Category 2, and all the MDs are getting Category 1.
That's not a statement.
So, yeah.
And I was just thinking of something, and when I was in school down in Arizona, one of the requirements was that for us was we had to attend one state medical board meeting.
Yeah, I remember doing that.
Yeah, and now I don't think we could host students here, but I wonder, because there's a school down in Ivins now, right?
Mm-hmm. So Larry and I actually went down last month and we lectured.
Okay, well, that is never mind.
Students.
That was my question.
That may end up being a yearly thing where you go down and we spend about an hour.
And probably like a few slides and then probably a lot of question and answer.
Slides and questions. And yeah. You know, a lot of these students, when they hear Doppel, the only thing that they think of is oh, Doppel is that software program the doctor gets on to see if someone's okay.
Right. Yeah, they think of it as the database.
And that's all they think that Doppel is. Because
I'd be interested. I mean, I like lecturing.
If you want,
sign you up for next year.
Just let me know.
If anyone wants to talk to the dean of the NCOM, I'm happy to connect you with him. If you want to lecture in any capacity, I mean, they've hired like half the administration and hiring faculty now. The renderings are done of the building. It's phenomenal. So if you want to see
this?
Provo at the Nordic College of Plastic Medicine opens in 2021.
I mean, I just think as a board, you know, I think one of the things that when I look at, like, advocacy for anesthesiology, we're trying to get our residents involved early and kind of get them educated of what it means to be involved with advocacy, both from the standpoint of advocating for your specialty, to advocating for your patients, to knowing how to... Or at least having an idea of what it means to go and talk to your local legislator and can make yourself available and that kind of thing. And I think we can do a similar type thing here with, you know, just good practice, you know, from the standpoint of, you know, like, you know, just letting people know, you know, have your boundaries before you start and then figure out your what you're
doing. I gave a talk at this CME conference of current osteopaths here several years ago, and there's about 50 in attendance. I asked show of hands if anyone knew what a boundary issue was, and had no idea. You know, it's just they don't know about it until they cross it and then before.
Yeah.
Do you guys want me to do a little introduction? Because
it may be something farther down
the line for a co-pass, and he'll be like right on the
maybe it may be something more down the road that you know, something comes that works more direct of what.
Yeah, if there's anything you guys want to connect with, that I'm happy to. You can shoot me an email if you want to.
So what do you do it with the? Are you involved with the school then?
Yeah. So I work for Rockmont University full time, and originally we were going to build a medical school under us, but then it ended up being a better situation for students to build it independently.
Yeah.
So they just held their first board of trustees meeting, and so now they're officially their own entity. Mm-hmm. Francis Gibson is the chair of the board of trustees.
Okay.
And they've hired some incredible people. Mike Rose at Intermountain Healthcare is now full time with the medical school. It's moving along really
good.
Well. Good. So I kind of just help a little bit of community engagement, making connections for the dean because he isn't from here.
The biggest thing that all the osteopaths are concerned with is beyond the quality of teaching in medical schools, because they're popping up everywhere, and there's a lot of money to make in owning and operating an osteopathic medical school, but there's no focus on residency programs. And that's our challenge. How many residents? So you created this many medical students, how many residency spots are you creating? And I've talked to deans and say, we're not interested in creating any residency spots.
Well, we're interested in creating any residency spots and paying for them.
And that's the challenge. So the we're talking not rotations, but actually
residencies.
It's the residency spots.
One of the reasons my growth came on.
That comes down to the individual hospitals that will do that.
And it is a challenge. That's the number one problem that we'll have, is because the U has a lot of the hospitals locked down.
Mm-hmm.
But there are all kinds of options, and so that's...
Yeah.
But the teaching, that's one of the things I would have, if you wanted to talk to him, whatever the timing is, the teaching model is unlike anything I've seen except for at Harvard. So we worked with Harvard with their model, so it's really educating people in pods instead of having mass classrooms that nobody goes to class. And so the facilities are designed with lots of small conference rooms, so students are put in pods, and they have to demonstrate competency as they navigate through things, and then they have lectures like on Friday about the things they don't know, not just things they know and they don't want to show up to. It's a really innovative educational model that addresses the learning needs of current students.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was one of the challenges when we first started was, as we interviewed Revere and Mountain and Mount Star back then, saying, tell us your issues with osteopathic education, people coming in, and they said, you know, we're getting people dumped on us that are poorly prepared, that we feel like we're doing all the training, we don't have time for this, and we need them to contribute. I mean, it's to the extent that they're going to be, these students will be trained on the software that Intermountain runs so they can contribute to documentation processes. So it's actually very, I think it's going to be one of the best medical schools they're working with. A holodeck building up, like on the holodeck, Star Trek reference, but it's going to be so tech savvy and current and be able to plop students and later residents right in and make, contribute and not suck the life out of a practice. And there's going to be opportunities to say, okay, take these people and we'll fund an additional provider so that we can offset. So the model is actually very thoughtful towards the healthcare systems and towards individual providers.
Good.
and the quality of education. The charge to the dean, or the hiring committee for the dean, is create the best medical school in the United States.
How many students per year?
COCA requires you do, I think, 50% of your max, so I think you can do 150 to 180 starts total a year, so I think the first cohort will start with 75.
Okay.
You have to build up to it. So 2021 fall would be anticipated start date, and it would be, I think, the 75 to start there. So, yeah, but it's pretty awesome. The renderings went live. The city released that in May through planning commission. So early April. It is May. So yeah, it's the whole idea is to create this incredible student experience that's not distracted by competition, or to create a campus environment that eliminates all these external stressors. So whether it's a dog park or daycare or whatever, it's very, very thoughtful. And that's how it comes out. The president of Rocky Mountain University is the president of EdCom. There's a dual role right now. And so it translates our culture. And the intent is that they're going to go for regional accreditation as well. Rocky Mountain has that thing of the U and Gibraltar and whatever. We have that same level. But the EdCom doesn't have to go for it. They only need COCA to run, but they want the best. And so they're anticipating going through not only the COCA, which has to, but to also go through the Northwest Commission, which is really optional for them. So, yeah, there's a lot of integrity with this. So, yeah, I'm always saying, you've got to come talk to it, because we've dealt with skeptics on this for 8 years, and rightfully so. There have been some bad apples. We understand that. But once people talk to Dr. Doherty and Dr. Nielsen, they see the vision, and that's why we've have people hop on and say, okay, RHC, you'll come on. That was the king skeptic of all of them. Mm-hmm. But we understand they have reason to be it. There's no...
Yeah, so IEC put out a letter that if any student ever contacts them for a rotation, that student will never step in their hospital again.
Yeah.
They've actually put that out as a statement from IEC.
How do you mean? So like,
they wrote a letter. So they wrote a letter that if a student ever approaches IEC and says, "Can I come to a rotation at your cardiology office?" That student will not get a rotation at that cardiology office. This was in April.
This year.
So
why?
Because a whole bunch of students were contacting IEC to do rotations. They were contacting IEC to do so.
Were they mostly DO students, or were
they're DO. So what has to happen? It has to originate at the doctor level. A doctor has to come and say, "Hey, I'm sponsoring." So it's the doctor telling IEC, "I'm sponsoring a student in my rotation." It's not someone blindly coming into Utah and saying, "Hey, IEC, I want to do a rotation," and I don't have a personal contact. And they're like, "No, if you don't have a personal contact, you're not getting a rotation."
There's been some bridges burned by osteopathic institutions who did not work on the relationship first.
People that were not.
We didn't go in and say, "What do you need?" If our goal with NCOM is to serve our local population and surrounding underserved populations, then first conversation you have is with healthcare systems.
Yeah.
So that's, we took a relationship approach first to help design curriculum and educational models and how the residencies and clinicals would work. And I think that's made all the difference. So you've gone from taking an inner mountain of skepticism and "heck no" was basically the answer to writing a letter of support. So we have letters of support from BYU and UVU and the healthcare system, including people on, people like Francis. Chairing the Board of Trustees. So it's gone from, people seeing this vision, because you said we've had done the wrong thing.
Yeah.
But this is all about people. In fact, one of the taglines that I think is going to come out is "people matter most." And that's, it's the students matter the most, the providers matter the most, it's like patients matter the most, and it really is.
Well, that's exciting. That's exciting to see from our profession.
Well, and then if you look at, even we follow the money on it, so the Nordas are the lead investors on the project.
Right.
They're dumping in $50 million and they're getting nothing back. They're investing into the students. Because they're sunsetting their foundation. So it's not about the Nordos putting in $50 million and just being like, ooh, we're going to make a ton of money. It's really an altruistic.
Mm-hmm. What's tuition going to be?
I have no idea. That one I don't.
The average around is about $58,000 a year.
I'm sure it'll be, it's not going to be like LeCom being the cheapest. I'm guessing it's going to be more, you know, I don't know, we'll have to see. But, yeah.
I know what I came out with debt-wise.
Yeah.
And I talked to some of the residents coming out now, and I'm like,
I mean, my last year,
and that's
25 years of paying.
Yeah.
And I looked at what I paid 25 years ago for school, or however about back in the early 90s, and I listened to some of these students, the debt they're incurring, and then they want to go into primary care, and it's like, you won't make it.
That's my biggest beef with the osteopathic schools. You know, almost like, you know, you go and you apply, and I could do primary care, and then all of a sudden you start looking at the financials, and then you know you realize, well, I need to do something else. I'm coming out with, you know, $250,000 in debt, and you know, so I got to do something, you know, else. But yet they're very expensive schools, and you know, it's like if you're really committed to primary care, then you need to, maybe that's your tuition, but if somebody's going into primary care, you need to offer some sort of incentive, you know, tuition incentive to help make that easier to do.
Yeah, part of I know that as they set the numbers, one of the biggest considerations is reducing stress on students. So the overhead costs for building this are going to be through the roof because of the technology and the pod setup. But I don't anticipate they'll take it out of the students' swoop. But I've been involved in many conversations that have been like, okay, we need to, part of this is reducing stress for students to increase their success in their learning. And part of that, it has to do with tuition, right? So I don't know. I haven't seen any official numbers. And at this point, now that they're split off from Rocky Mountain, and our mother company that was managing the development, we're the only entities under Wasatch Educational. But so I might not be involved as closely as I once was, but I've been involved with conversations where the sensitivity to student tuition was there.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, when you have investors, I mean, there are lots of investors that will, you know, have good equity, but your lead investor is not going to be pushing for.
As far as stress among medical students, what's changed from our generation to it currently is the use of Adderall.
Yeah.
Not because they have ADD or ADHD, it's because they've got to compete with their other students.
Right.
And they will go and lie to a doctor so that they can get their Adderall, because otherwise they're fighting for class standing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, what about if medical school never had a class standing?
And
there is zero class standing.
Yep.
But I know one medical school where about 90% of students are on Adderall,
yep,
just to out-compete each other, just dog, and it's
we've had that.
The problem with that, though, is not having a class standing. And there's other allopathic institutions, too. I think it's Stanford. Anyway, I was on the residency selection committee for a couple of years at U, and the problem is, you know, sometimes they're coming in without a class standing, and people are like, well, we don't know how to evaluate. Well, there's plenty of other ways to evaluate people. There's board scores, there's letters of recommendation, there's, you know, just talking to them, you know, finding out, you know, if there's a, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
I was probably, like, right in the middle of my class, and like I've been fairly successful, so I don't really care about class standing.
There's other metrics.
Yeah, and there's a vice president that was hired, or a dean, I'm not sure what her rank is, but she's former vice president out of Kaplan, who came in and did all the prep courses to make sure they passed really well.
Yeah.
And so she's coming in with a different perspective on how to make sure everybody just rocks their boards.
Yeah.
And so it's...
It's a balance.
Interesting.
It's a balance. You don't want to teach to just teach
just
to the board.
Forward.
But you also want them to be able to be successful.
Yep. They've got to be employable for sure. So I mean, the interesting thing, I think you want to reach out to me.
Thank you for sharing. Yeah. We're going to go ahead and get the board meeting closed unless there's any other things. Okay. It is now 10:20 a.m. and this meeting is adjourned.
Purdue University bought Kaplan.
Yes.
And then they're doing a thing where you can, in certain programs, there's no tuition for the student, but the student agrees to pay a percentage of their income and to pay it back.
Wow, that's
it
interesting.
It can be up to 17% for 4 years. And that pays back as a fund, but then they use the fund as a
scholarship.
Well, and some of the, I can't remember which Ivy League school, but they I don't know if they have already, but they are planning to go no tuition for medical school.
Yeah.
Columbia, Harvard, you know, those schools like that, Stanford could probably do, because their endowments are so big. Like,
yeah.
I think the amount of endowment that Harvard has now, they could just say nobody pays tuition ever again,
yeah.
And they would not go in the red.
Yeah.
But anyway.
It's not a luxury across the whole country.
No,
it's
not.
Yeah.
You know what, though? I'll tell you this. My experience is there are good academic programs that have these names that are just
yeah.
phenomenal. And then there are the programs like the one where I went, which is the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And, you know, there's research that happens there. But
yeah.
it's a public institution. It is phenomenal clinical education.
Yeah.
And because you just go and you just do.
Yeah.
And, you know, preparation to be able to go out and take care of anybody
yeah.
is the first priority. And I have this conversation with people all the time. We have a chair who's a researcher. I mean, he's an anesthesiologist, but he was a pretty big researcher, but he's also been a clinical guy, a good anesthesiologist. And Vivian Lee, kind of, I think, made this mistake, came in to try and transform the U into, like, this powerhouse research institution, which the problem is, and this goes back to the endowment, we don't have the endowment of Harvard or Duke or Stanford or Johns Hopkins or, you know, those institutions have that can fund the research. We rely a lot on, not solely, but a lot on the clinical endeavor to pay for the research
yeah.
that we do. And we've got pretty good clinical outcomes.
Yeah.
I mean, we're known to be a high-quality clinical place. So if we start trying to say,